Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Firstly, of course, I'd like to welcome you to Just Not Good Enough. One of the things that spotted immediately was that you've done over 100 podcasts yourself.
Yeah.
So, and you've got a list of achievements as long as your arm, you know, from here to bloody France. I mean, Christ, and you're half my age. I mean, this is not good. Well, it is good, actually, but it's not good, you know. And I just think, wow, I think I need to learn from you. I think the tables need to be turned.
Well, I don't know. I feel that I've lived at speed. I've been through some things that have helped me to really get clear on what's meaningful to me and what difference I can make. And I think that's actually come from having some significant challenges at a younger age.
Yeah.
And I think that's made me and forced me to live more meaningfully and also live quite quick, do numerous different things, have probably quite a few careers already. But that's created such an opportunity to learn, and I suppose I'm still living like that and just continually learning. I'm ultimately...
I love it. Yeah,
I'm a curious child. That's what I am.
I used to be similar, but I haven't done what you've done. But I used to be similar. I used to take my dad's watch apart to find out how it worked. And then, funnily enough, I couldn't put it back together again.
Yes.
So, you know, massive curiosity, which kills the cat, you know, gets you into trouble.
It does.
So experiences of your early childhood, because you started selling stuff, didn't you, at 12?
Yeah, so I was that child who, I mean, funnily enough, I used to have an Amiga 1200.
Well, I'm an oldie. That's a computer game thing, isn't it?
So, like, do you know the Commodore 64?
Yeah, yeah.
It was like the older brother of that.
Oh, right, okay.
So that was the first time I was able to actually... So my uncle got me into that. My uncle was like massively into his computers in the 80s. And early 90s.
Oh, that's early. That is early.
And, you know, that was his passion and very much his purpose. So he got me a Commodore 64. I tapped around on that as a 7, 8, 9-year-old. He then got me an Amiga. And I started buying, like, the magazines. And actually, what I did is, through my dad, set up a bit of a mail order company for an Amiga games. But obviously, not being old enough to have a bank account, not being old enough to actually list in the magazine, I just used my dad as a proxy and did it through that. And obviously, in those days, with a mail order company, you could be completely faceless and it's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
And I kind of then amplified that by thinking, right, how can I take this into my school environment? So I was that kid wheeling around like a, you know, a keep cool
container. What did the teachers say?
Well, they did me on health and safety pretty quickly. apparently, I didn't have like any kind of register or license to sell food.
In those days, health and safety hadn't existed.
Well, the thing is, the teachers wanted to find a way to stop me bringing and wheeling this cool box around. So they gradually did me on some kind of idea that actually I wasn't allowed to do this. But it changed, Chaz. It was like, you know, you haven't got a license to sell food at school. Yeah, but tell me what licenses I need. Yeah. Then it became, you know, you're not allowed to bring additional things beyond the bags that you need for your lessons.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, but actually tell me or show me where that's in some kind of policy.
Yeah.
Then it became, you know, you're not allowed to leave your cool box in certain
places. So they put up a barrier.
Yeah.
You break that barrier down.
Yeah.
And then they just put another one up.
The goalposts just continue to move. It's the educational system.
So didn't that put you off?
Well,
being an entrepreneur, because I mean you are a very successful entrepreneur, so I mean, that's quite a bad experience at that age. Most kids would probably say, "Oh,
well." The problem is, I'm fairly contrarian by nature. So if people actually say, "No, you can't do it," I'm the kind of person who's saying, "Okay, so if I can't do it like this, how can I do it?" And I suppose in some ways I've got like a bit of an engineer's mind. So I'm like, "Okay, so maybe this experiment hasn't worked. Someone's put some barriers in the way. How can I experiment to remove those?" So for me, it's actually, you know, you present a challenge, I'm more likely to go and actually do it. And I suppose that happened in a big way with my first business because, you know, I was in my last year of university, you know, thinking I want to set up a business. I created a business plan, created forecasts, you know, market opportunity,
How old were you then?
So I was 20.
Okay.
20,
okay.
21.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought, I can definitely build this. I wanted a mentor, someone who'd done it, someone who built something, someone who knew the pathways, knew the challenges, because I knew that I was young and in some ways I'd probably fall into a lot of pitfalls if I didn't have anyone, because I didn't have anyone in my network.
Yeah.
You know, I'm brought up in a council estate in Bolton. You know, no one
great
really,
accent, by the way.
Yeah,
I love your accent.
But no one in my kind of immediate network had gone and set up a business and been massively successful with it, just because of the people I was surrounded by. So I wanted to find those people.
Did you stay in the area? So I'm going to interrupt you. I say this yeah. to everybody. I'm going to interrupt you. So yeah. I apologize in advance, but clearly you can do the same to me.
Yeah, of course.
But did you leave the area, or did you continue to work in that area, still surrounded by those people?
So I kind of moved out to Manchester to go to university, and suddenly had a bit more of a scope of people. But even when you go to university and you come from a poorer background, you end up hanging about university with those from a poorer background as well. Just because you've got a lot more in common with those people.
Yeah, that's true. You naturally gravitate towards them.
So yeah. I still had a network of people who, you know, some of them were more affluent than I was, but, you know, we're all young.
So do you enjoy swimming against the stream then? Because it sounds like you are, because all the people that you're with are not doing that. They're probably just trying to find their way somehow. But you're thinking, I need to do something different to break out of this.
Well, I think if you look at what the word entrepreneur actually means, it means to swim against the tide.
Does it?
That's what it means, because if you take it back to like ancient French, it actually means to swim out.
I didn't know that.
So you obviously taking,
I'm going to write that down. There's lots of things I write down these days.
You're taking a risk when you go and swim out. Yeah. You know, to be honest, most businesses don't make it in their original form. Some make it really well in a form way beyond what they originally started to think it was going to be, but most become experiments to learn from. And you know, you're taking a risk doing that, and it's really hard, to be honest, if you've not got a lot of a safety net.
I'm an angel investor, mm-hmm. right? Or I was. I don't anymore, because the Superdry share price has been shit. But yeah, don't laugh. It's not funny, actually.
No, keep a straight face.
Yeah, please keep a straight face. It's 40p or something now, and it was £20. So nasty. But I come across these businesses like yours, mm-hmm. you know, where you're looking for their first round of finance and mm-hmm. so on. And they say that something like 95% fail in the first year.
Yeah.
And of the 5% that go into the second year, 95% of them fail. And that's my experience, actually.
Yeah.
But you've got two, haven't you, that mm-hmm. or three, I think, that are still going?
So one that's been acquired.
Oh, okay.
And it's still, I suppose, kind of going, but it's been merged into a much, much bigger entity.
That's all right. That's still going.
So that's still going.
Yeah.
It's got a legacy.
Yeah.
I've got the one that I run today.
Yeah.
And a social enterprise that I've just set up.
Oh, tell me about that one then, the social enterprise.
So that social enterprise is working with young boys and using the money from corporate training to help men engage, become more emotionally intelligent, naturally become better leaders for a world that's changing, and also look how they can support women in that journey as well.
Yeah, you know, I've done a dozen of these or something, mm-hmm. but this is the first. I mean, I'm always in admiration of the people that I talk to, but particularly you, because of, you know, I'm getting a bit gushy now, but mm-hmm. because of what you do and what you've achieved, and you know, everything that I've read about you, I just think, Christ, that's good. And I think there was one thing I read right at the towards the end, is you want to deal with prevention, not cure, and mm-hmm. in the same way that, you know, I'm on blood pressure tablets and all the other sort of stuff. Because it's about preventing me having a disease, which then affects the NHS.
Yeah.
But you're going a little bit further than that, because you're looking at the issues that are going to come for the young in 20, 30 years' time, and actually doing something about it now.
Yeah.
I don't know I've ever met anybody who's doing that. Everybody seems to be addressing the problem that we've got now for the right reasons. But so what gave you the light to do that?
I suppose in a lot of ways, Chaz. I think firstly, like, you talk about this list of achievements, right? But the list of achievements is like, it doesn't have that much meaning when you chart it out and see the impact that you've had over time. It's actually about thinking about how do we solve tomorrow's problems today? Because as human beings, we've got big, big problems as a species, right? And, you know, we've got some...
I despair, actually, if I'm honest.
We've got some wicked challenges.
Yeah.
And the only way we're going to solve those is to come together, collaborate and do things by looking how can we solve some of the problems that are up the stream, you know, by going even further up the stream. Because at the minute, we're pulling people out as they're about to fall off the side.
Yeah, we are, yeah.
Right at the bottom.
Yeah.
Why don't we look at the root? To be honest, it never made sense why we problem solve at the very end of the problem. Why are we not, firstly, going preventative, but secondly, going proactive within that? because it's easy to be quite reactionary even when you're being preventative. And for me, it's like, how do we actually become proactive? And instead of thinking, we'll wait till the problem comes and then we'll deal with it. You know, is that how we should be living life as human beings?
No.
We're incredibly resourceful. Look what we've evolved into from where we were.
Yeah.
You know, we did that by thinking, what's coming? Oh, an ice age is coming. We're best, you know, start making some level of shelter so we've got some protection. We need to start migrating to the warmer climates. You know, we were always thinking and listening to the world and thinking something is coming, let's do something about it.
But there's a lot of short-termism, isn't there? Like you just said yourself, I know, I mean, you look like you're despairing there, which, you know, and partly that's down to the politicians, which we won't go into that subject, but it's just for the here and now, and people complain about the here and now, but you're taking very much a long view, and I try to do the same thing myself, actually, because I've got kids. I think you've got kids as well.
Yes.
Yeah. And mine are 27 and 31. And you know, they're going to be living through the issues that we've got now that, you know, my generation and generations before, and indeed my generation, have created. And I just think, how the hell, but there's so many things all coming together all at once. What can we do about it? But you've actually, I mean, I think about it. I would say intellectually, but that's not true. I just think about it. But I don't really do anything about it, if I'm honest. But you do. And before you respond to that, right, there's... I'm told that you like complexity. Right? So in that sense, you don't just look at something from one point of view, like there's a problem with this, let's solve that problem. So you take a many functional... dimensional view of a situation. So how do you make sense of all of that? How do you cut between it and say, if I do this, it'll have that, it'll have the biggest impact, when there's all of these other factors involved?
Yeah, so I think probably numerous things, Chaz. I think me being artistic, that's...
Autistic?
Yeah.
Are you?
So I'm artistic, and I think that plays into that being able to see and joining those dots. Right, because obviously we all exist within this ecosystem. So many things are interconnected and we don't think about it. And I suppose even like back to what you were saying earlier, we are very short-termist and thinking, what do we need to solve today? But we're absolutely hopeless at living in the present moment as humans as well. We're like an awful paradox.
God, aren't we? Yeah.
But kind of, I suppose being artistic does help me see this kind of systems thinking in my head and seeing how... like changing one variable can impact other variables. It's a bit like thinking about the medication that you're on, for example, and you've got it solves this symptom.
Yeah.
It has 10 potential interactions with other medications and probably 20 potential side effects.
Yes.
The system looks at it like that and understands that this medication might solve this, it probably has a decent chance of solving it. That's how it's got through to being in the medical system. But it's also got a chance potentially interacting with these other 10 medications to do something that's not good, and 20 potential side effects, which you might not like.
Yeah, ironically, I'm sorry, I am going to interrupt you again, but ironically, I mean, I'm on sertraline, which is a depression medicine, same as Alistair Campbell, I might add. Yep. So, you know, me and him are like that now. Mm-hmm. Well, we're not actually, but I read the side effects, and they do the top 10, and one in 10 people, and number 6 was depression. And I'm thinking, hold on a minute, you know, this, how does that work? This is supposed to be helping with depression, but a side effect is depression. So that complexity is something that, because of the way you think, I guess, you get some clarity out of that.
Yeah, I mean, I like the complexity, but the truth is, you've got to be able to do that and then make it simple to talk to other people about it. Because people don't want you pulling them from area to area, from... It for most people, that just seems too fragmented and too disconnected. And how did you go from here? Suddenly you're off on a tangently, and that doesn't make sense. So actually, the job is to look at things in a complex way and know that if you tweak one thing, it's probably going to impact 5 other things.
Yeah.
And try and... because that's what you have to kind of do when you're looking at things scientifically. You need to look at what variables are being impacted. So I suppose I kind of take that approach into my own life. It's very much like experimenting, right? You know that you're going to change something, change one tiny thing in an experiment, and suddenly the results will be different out of the other side. So I try and take that approach to life without being constrained by it always having to be that rigid.
It does require, though, doesn't it, experimentation, you've said yourself, because you're, no matter, I mean, complex things, the chaos theory is really complicated, funnily enough. You know, so identifying that little one thing that will change something is quite hard. So you just give it a go and see what happens, I guess.
Yeah, but we all know what it's like if you get a fly in your soup, right? It's only quite small, but it completely ruins it. So there's an appreciation for actually, you know, the little changes can actually make a big difference.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's when human beings firstly look at themselves and individually make small changes, right? We're in a society where we love big transformations. We love New Year's resolutions. And, you know, by February, everyone's like, oh,
no,
that was a big dream.
No,
but actually,
January the 15th.
Well, exactly. And it's like well documented that, you know, the majority of the population has gone big and they've gone home by that point.
Yeah.
But actually, small compounding changes as humans, we don't notice them very much, but they compound like savings do, like pensions do.
Yeah.
In fact, those little micro moments of things that you do compound tax-free.
Yeah, but you could see they've happened throughout the course of my life. You know, I mean, they're not, some of them are not simple, but or little. But seatbelts, for example, in cars. I mean, that had an absolute transformation on car safety, number of deaths, et cetera, et cetera. And one I've used before on this program is the 10p for a plastic bag.
Yep.
Dropped by 90%. I mean, really simple and has a major impact. But I can't do it. I can't do it, I guess, is get to that thing that says, yeah, that's the bit that will make the difference. And in a way, I'm sort of slightly scared of trying as well.
Yeah, I think that fundamentally, if we explore life, if we are, because curiosity is like a compelling human trait. We all have that curiosity. But being an adult's like the best marketing campaign you've ever seen. It's almost like you suddenly are not really supposed to be curious anymore. You're not supposed to play around. You're not supposed to test things as an adult. You're almost kind of bamboozled and, you know, provoked into thinking that you need to have answers to everything.
Yeah.
And that you actually need to be very responsible. Yeah. And you actually need to stop exploring and adventuring like humans do. And actually, you need to go and seek comfort and, you know, build expertise.
Well, work your way to retirement and ultimately death.
Yeah. You know, as humans, we used to have a really defined target. So humans are teleological beings, right?
A what?
Teleological.
What does
so
that
mean? So we're target driven.
Oh, right, okay.
We need some kind of outcome to move towards. Think about it like an archer, right? As if a human being was an archer and you had no target to fire at, you'd get really bored firing your arrows because there's nothing to fire at, right?
Yeah.
We become aimless.
Yeah.
We're aiming for nothing. We have no reason to keep shooting. We just end up giving up and thinking, what's the point?
Yeah.
So we are target-driven, but our target as human beings used to be survive till reproductive age, keep the species alive.
Yes.
And we managed to build this world where we're safe and we kind of now last until our bodies don't last anymore. So the question is, what replaces that target of survival when we've managed to beat the target?
Yeah.
And the truth is, as a human, you now need to define that target for yourself. And there's so many influences and people telling you what that target needs to be. Success. In the typical capitalistic British way of you know, going and taking on the world, and whether that's, you know, going fighting on the front lines, whether that's, you know, becoming a millionaire, people have got all these influences about what target should be, you know, family, 4.2 children, you know, big house in the Cotswolds, you know, whatever, whatever you're
which
told.
Which is where I live.
but the thing is, people's vision of success is being told by the narrative around them, right? For some people, the version of success is not being in prison.
Yeah.
Because many of the people...
Or coming off drugs or whatever.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Sometimes it's the other side. It's not attaining something, it's avoiding something.
Yeah.
But we all end up having these targets of what success means. And my version of success, coming all the way back to the point we made earlier, is when I went out to find that mentor, I went and found someone in his 50s in Manchester, two successful businesses. I got half an hour in his diary. I walked in there as like a 21-year-old with my little business plan, my little folder, my forecast, my financials, market opportunity matrix.
Did you have the FT under your arm?
if I could have, I probably would have, just to make, you know, a bit of pink paper and make me look like I've been really doing my research right.
Yeah.
But I'd kind of done it, and I'd printed out all my stuff, laid it on the desk in front of this, you know, businessman, and kind of spent first 20 minutes laying it all out, my idea, how I'd charted it out, how I'd identify the market opportunity, competitor analysis, laid it all out to him. And he looked me dead in the eye and he said, "Lee, it's got legs, this."
How did that make you feel? That's a terrible question, actually.
So that at the time made me feel, oh, bit of validation.
Yeah.
This guy knows his stuff. He's built businesses. I've not. That's great. Then he said, "You know what? Market opportunities there. Forecasts look realistic. You know, this is, you know, you've done some good work here, young man." And then he continued. Then he said, But
yeah.
And he said, "Lee."
Then come the roadblocks, I guess. Yeah.
"You're young, you're black, got a bit of an attitude, haven't got any investment behind you, and you haven't got a network. Go out into industry, smooth your rough edges, get some people behind you, and go and try again later in your life."
What did you do?
So,
I bet you didn't.
No.
I bet you got the network, but I bet you didn't try later in your life.
The thing is, I actually went and got a grad scheme.
Ah, okay.
Because there were times when you actually think, maybe this person's right, because they've done it.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until I got made redundant from my grad scheme in the financial crash in 2008 that I actually thought, this going, smoothing my rough edges and building my network, it's been impacted by external winds that I can control.
Yeah, you see, as an angel investor, that your profile that you talked about there, that would be actually quite attractive, because suddenly you've got somebody who's motivated,
mm-hmm.
you know, goes out on a limb, is not afraid of hard work, you know, all of those sorts of things. And I'm thinking, and if the idea's got legs, you think, well, you know, that's pretty good. You don't actually want to change the person, because that's what you want to invest in. But this person was trying to change you, it sounded like.
Well, I think that he kind of saw it as, I think he was trying to be realistic, that you've got a great idea, but go and just round yourself more as a human being before going. What I think he was saying is, you're going to struggle to get in those rooms. That's what he was saying. I think he was trying to say that you're going to struggle, because ultimately, and this is 15 years ago,
It shouldn't have been like that, should it? It shouldn't. Certainly not because you're black, for Christ's sake.
No, but I think what he was saying is you're stepping into a very, very white dominant industry.
Yeah.
And in those places in Europe, around those tables where decisions get made in this industry, they're not going to be pulling
up
a chair for you.
That's very common. That is very common around all businesses.
Yeah.
White, middle-aged, grey hair, and a bit younger now, but so, slight diversity.
I mean, I reflect back and think, I don't hold any malice towards that particular situation. And actually, I believed enough to go and try and smooth the rough edges. Did I learn an awful lot in 8 months? Well, yeah, I learned, again, the gratitude of, you know, realising that the external winds can even take you out of a career like that very, very quickly. Makes you realise just how, you know, important it is to build a resilient business when you go and build one yourself.
Yeah, was that business that you spoke about one that you're doing, or you did do?
So,
was it one of your three or four?
So, yeah, it was the first one.
Oh, was it? Right. But, and that's now you've exited that one.
Yeah, but even better, I would say that, what was it, just under 18 months between that initial meeting and launching, I actually ended up launching at a better time because of that delay.
Right, because it was the 2008, presumably.
Yeah.
So you're now talking 2009, 10 or whatever.
So I actually hit a really kind of good digital transition point then.
Yeah.
When consumer attitudes started to change because people's, you know, were being squeezed. But digital adoption was also amplified in that time.
Yeah.
So I actually hit a great point of kind of business adoption. So actually,
it turned out okay.
If I'd have gone earlier, I'd have probably struggled to get traction.
Yeah.
And maybe actually not got the level of traction that I did. So actually, I look back and reflect and think that delay was actually probably a good thing.
Even though at the time you probably thought, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that also makes me realize sometimes your kind of hard-headedness and naivety of youth can be really powerful. But actually, sometimes it can also, you know, be the thing that shoots you in the foot.
Yeah.
And having
Yeah, it's tricky. It's tricky to know which is which, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Is it impetuousness? Is it good to stop doing something? You know, I mean, we don't know because you can't predict the future.
Well, no. I would say all entrepreneurs need a level of, can't even remember how I phrase it, but a level of naivety to think that things are going to work. Because if you look realistically, generally you'll look at it and think, geez.
Yeah, too difficult.
Yeah, you need to have a level of kind of risk appetite, but also a level of knowing your financials. Like there's these fine balances, isn't there? Because ultimately, if you have this massive risk appetite and you simply don't keep a handle on your financials, it's not.
Well, you are going to fail.
You are going to fail.
Yeah,
and it's like, how do you find these balances between things that ultimately, like, really being and appreciating, like, you know, your EBITDA and just being focusing on those things is quite a risk averse way of thinking, right? But actually, you've got to harness the bits of that and realize that they're not mutually exclusive.
Yeah,
you're not just risk averse or just, you know, high risk appetite. You can pick bits from each one of those mindsets to really be able to do the great things that you do.
It's interesting because when I was at Superdry, right, Julian Dunkerton, who's the founder, as you probably know, I mean, he was unbelievably creative.
Yeah.
Right? And I got there and I thought, bloody hell, fire, you know, this is shit. You know, there literally weren't any controls, really.
Yeah.
It was all in his head.
Yeah.
You know, stock controls, invoice, you know, forget it. Right. You know, the stock was there because Julian said it had to be there, but there's no record of it being there. Anyway, so put a structure in. And I've changed what I saw the role of a finance director is.
Yeah.
By saying, okay, Julian, that's what you want to do. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to prevent that creativity, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to sweep up after you.
Yeah.
And I talk about this when I do the odd talk. And I stick a picture of a road sweeper up and said, that's me.
Yeah.
Right. Because I'm clearing up the chaos and making it work that gives him the freedom. And that's almost what you should have been told at that point, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. So I kind of reflect back knowing the kind of the founder teams and the C-suites that I do. And especially on that kind of founder early stage scale-up journey, you want a founder who's the one who kind of chucks grenades at people.
Yeah.
And you want like a COO or a CFO, someone who dismantles those grenades, right? So they're coming up with these ideas, and these ideas are literally like fizzing grenades. They literally pop the pin and they're like off.
Yeah.
They literally throw it behind them. You need someone
who
has that, right, we have structure, we have rigor.
It's quite a hard role for somebody to play, though, isn't it?
Because they're running round, and you need to have all that structure, but also be agile enough to run around after the grenades.
Yeah. Yeah, and know where they are, apart from anything else. Yeah, yeah.
So you need that relationship with someone who fundamentally is probably a very different thinker and way of worker than you, and find that synergy and not feel resentful that they are keep creating chaos and you're continually having to dismantle and disarm things.
Oh, God, it's resonating. It fills me with horror when I think about it. You know, all the stuff that we did, or that Julian did, Jesus Christ.
Literally throwing explosives at you and you're there like, all right, I've got about 5 minutes to dismantle this one.
Yeah, 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 before I know there's another one in the midair over there. Yeah, I know. Anyway, look, I want to come back to your degenerative.
Yes.
Is it degenerative? Is it?
No, it's chronic. So it's chronic kind of management.
Okay. But it happened very suddenly.
Yep.
And yet, after a very short period of time, you got your mind together to say, this is how I'm going to handle it. Just talk me through that as to what happened and how you managed to be so mindful and so clear and calm about it. At the point where a lot of people would have just cracked up completely.
Yeah, so I think...
You don't mind talking about it, do you?
No, I think there's probably two things, Chaz. So, firstly, going through mental health challenges at university, dropping out, having to go back again.
Yes, I want to talk about that at some point.
Gave me kind of some tools, and also some kind of adversity. Stuff happens, can't control everything. What can you influence? And some kind of tools to kind of just think a bit more widely about things. Also then being made redundant from my grad scheme was like, that was a hit, but again that adversity made me more self-aware and made me more grateful. So when this happened,
grateful, like, that's an interesting word.
Yeah, but like I mean, back to that, I had colleagues who, 25 years in finance, more letters after the name than the alphabet, but they couldn't get an equivalent role anywhere. And
sounds familiar.
Well, fundamentally, they were quite heavily leveraged. Mortgages, families, holidays, things, you know. And suddenly, they were like applying for jobs like for a quarter of the salary.
Yeah.
Because that's all that was out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was grateful that I was just at the start of my career. And
okay, right. Grateful in that sense.
Yeah. So I was incredibly grateful for that. But when it happened, I was like any human being. Why me? Why now? I have no control over this. I've lost my mobility, my physicality. I've got nurses taking me to the toilet. This ain't great. And that's how I felt. I felt like any human would do. And anyone who says this, something like this happens, and you're like, oh, no, this is fine, are either completely deluded or they're lying.
Yeah.
Because you as a human being, when something like this happens...
I mean, it obviously affected your mental health and well-being, clearly.
Yes.
Yeah. But can you describe the emotions that that gave you? So, I mean, I know, it would affect... Because I know how I feel when I get in a period of depression.
Yeah.
It'd just be interesting to hear how you... If you can put it into words. Because I find it really difficult to put it into words, actually.
Yeah, so I think there's an element of fear there. And, like, kind of feeling that things are out of your control. And that creates a level of discomfort. I think that...
Anxiety?
Well, yeah, and I think that you kind of... I suppose it gets you thinking about how you can solve things. It's like everything works in like loops and cycles. It's like a big, big feedback mechanism. So I'm kind of there thinking, oh, well, this isn't right. Okay, so what can I do about it? And I suppose if you kind of think about how it took about 2 weeks to get to a good place.
Which is a remarkably short period of time.
But then I had a lot of people to speak to. So I tried to think... I feel in a really bad place. How can I express this in a healthy way to those who are coming to visit? Without it sounding like I'm just mourning and down, but they can see it's not good.
Well,
So they've got some context. But I also kind of journaled. So I wrote down like stuff from my head, got it down, got it out of my head. Just gave me the space to actually start to think, you know, okay, so what can I do? But the biggest thing for me, Charles, was I was in Blackburn Hospital, right, looking, and I got moved to a higher ward next to the window, looking out across the moors, right?
Aww.
So I had this view in the morning, you know, sun was out, green fields, looking across to Bolton, right, where I was born.
Yeah.
And I lay there one morning, and I just realised, just dawned on me, right, I've walked over those moors. Can't walk now. I've ever been grateful for walking.
Yes, I've read that about you.
And then it occurred to me.
That's just a remarkable thought.
It just dawned on me like, no. I've never sat there and thought, I'm grateful that I can walk. And at that point, I just realised, what else have I not been grateful for? And it just like expanded my mind. I was like, you know what? Like, you were born and brought up in the UK. You've had access to free education, free healthcare. You've never been hungry or homeless. You've had freedom to set up a business. In fact, you're in hospital now not worrying about being on standard sick pay and not being able to pay your mortgage because you've got a business. That's giving you the financial freedom to focus on your recovery rather than worrying about how you're going to keep a roof over your head for your family. You've got people who come and visit you. You've got a support network. In fact, Lee, there's pretty much... There's nothing that you don't have, mate.
That is remarkable clarity. Excuse me. Remarkable clarity in a time of stress, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people's emotions would be running riot. And I know when I get depressed, I can't think clearly at all. I have one or two thoughts in my head and they just stay there. And I can't get rid of them, you know, no matter how hard I try. And I've got all the things that similar things that you've got. And I get this deep, dark feeling and heavy weight in my between my brain.
Yeah,
I mean, but so for you, can I ask you what might be an insensitive question?
Yeah.
Do you think your autism helped you to process that?
So I think there might have been some of that rationalisation that you quite often get when you're autistic, where you just, I think I just probably, like I said earlier, map things out in my head.
Yeah.
And think, right, okay, what can I do? And kind of took some of the heat out of the situation. I also think that in a comical way, I was on Oramar from Tramadol because I was in so much pain. My body was like on fire.
So you're fuzzy as
and,
well.
And that kind of fuzziness, right, I don't remember much of that period particularly well.
Were you journaling then?
But I was definitely journaling, and I think looking back on those journals, yeah, I can, because people
you're away with the fairies.
People told me, geez, you were like, I came to see you and you just weren't you. And I was like, what do you mean? And then I look back on some of my journal entries and I'm like, okay.
What was the handwriting like?
I understand. The handwriting was, I mean, my handwriting is terrible. My handwriting is like Dr. Squiggly writing. I'm looking at your notes and thinking, what lovely, lovely cursive writing. Then
no,
if you saw
really,
if you saw my writing, you'd okay. be like, okay. you'd realize yeah. your writing yeah. was good. But no, I mean, my handwriting was probably better than it normally was because I was probably in such a like a languid state. But no, I just, I mean, I reflect back, Chaz, and it just, I suppose what happened is I'd been through adversity before and known I could get through it. So I felt like I could if I just got out of my own way and got some of my thoughts and feelings down and spoke to people and processed some of those emotions. And I realised, you know, if you suppress them, you will continue to suffer.
Yeah.
If you find a way to express them healthily, you will find a way to keep moving forward.
Right, which is a neat way of starting to talk about business, because you do an awful lot now in terms of coaching and workspaces and all of that sort of stuff. And I was very interested to find out that you take a multidisciplinary view to helping other businesses. Maybe this is one of your entrepreneurial businesses you've set up, about the actual workspace itself. And in a way, I really like that idea, apart from the fact that I probably wouldn't know how to do it, right? But the way that you'd think about the workspace, so it's almost like you're doing well-being without letting them know. You're sort of creating an environment. And maybe there are, you know, the odds coaching sessions and mentoring sessions and stuff going on, but actually it's the environment that is of fundamental importance. Could you just, have I got that right? And secondly, could you just talk a bit about what all of that is about?
Yeah, so I suppose fundamentally the business that I've got today started in that area, thinking about what impacts well-being in the workplace. And obviously environment is quite a significant one. Now, I kind of launched that business just as the pandemic was happening. So it was quite a different time. I suppose it's now a different business than it was initially built to be.
Which is always the case, isn't it? With startups, they morph very quickly into other things.
And there was a beauty of the reality that if you build a startup into a world where everything's been chucked in the air, the status quo has been broken, and people are having to do things they've never done before, it just gives you so much space as a startup to actually be a startup without expectations that you know exactly what you're becoming and what you're doing.
Yeah.
So it creates a lovely sandbox for a lot of, and I know some of the startups out of the pandemic will be similar to startups out of the 08 recession that, you know, have literally changed industries because they had space and time to do it without people saying, that's a bit strange, because everyone was running around saying, oh my God, like there's a pandemic and we might die. So it creates an interesting distraction.
Yeah.
But yeah, we kind of looked and thought, how what influences people's well-being? And fundamentally, workspaces do. All of a sudden, the pandemic happened and people were able to curate their own workspace. But it also presented...
Well, at work and at home. I mean, at home, obviously. Well,
especially at home, because they were able to suddenly create and chisel out a workspace for themselves, which showed what could happen when people had control and autonomy over it. But also, not everyone has a nice home office, right? Some people were working with an ironing board, you know, as a desk.
Yeah, but somebody I know is working out of their bedroom.
Yeah, you know, and a lot of young people were working out of their kind of shared bedroom,
which became
they slept, where they ate, where they worked.
That's
not blurred all those boundaries.
Yeah, yeah.
So we were kind of looking and thinking, you know, what's the world going to look like and how can we get people to have better health outcomes? And I'm focused on what are the barriers? What's stopping people being well? Because the workplace brings a really diverse group of people together. I think for most people, the people that they work with are a more diverse group than their social or family network, generally speaking.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about that. Yes, you're probably right, yeah.
And workplaces bring people from all different cultures, all different backgrounds together to do things with a shared common goal. So I was like, how can we get people to, you know, be more well? we kind of started looking at environments. We've actually morphed into thinking about environments in a wider context. So environments in terms of how people actually feel, not just the physical environment as well. So stuff around psychological safety.
Yeah.
And the kind of the culture.
I'm glad you used that phrase because that's absolutely key. Yeah, but keep
going. And
the
cultural environment that we're building. So now the company really focuses on that. How do we create environments where people are psychologically safe? And that is like a precursor to actually being well. The truth is psychological safety and psychological comfort are very different things. And
yes,
it's important that we kind of...
Explain the distinction.
Yeah. So psychological safety is the ability for people to share ideas without being ridiculed, to make mistakes and have the space to be able to learn from them. Psychological safety is the ability to be able to actually be who you are and bring those talents and skills and those different ways of thinking and actually build better products and services together and fostering opportunities to collaborate and for listening to each other and being able to appreciate, you know, those diverse viewpoints.
The bit I liked was the first bit you said there about not being ridiculed.
Yeah, so it's that, you know, that ability to come in and actually...
Yeah, but express yourself.
Express yourself, yeah. Whereas psychological comfort is this idea that, you know, you should be able to come and just be comfortable at work.
And the physically comfortable?
Well, the thing is, like, physical comfort is quite important, you know. Like, wherever you work should be firmly comfortable.
Yeah, it's got to be warm, adequate
lighting, ventilation. No,
proper chairs, all that sort of stuff.
Well, those are just simple things. And, you know, that kind of comfort, I think that comfort simply, if you're uncomfortable, you don't work well.
No.
It impacts everything. In fact, if you're uncomfortable in a workplace, you're probably going to leave physically because if you're in pain, you're not going to be thinking about anything else. But in terms of that psychological comfort, some people think that they should be able to go to work and just do what they want. And you have to find that balance, you know, psychological comfort.
Do you know, sorry, I'm interrupting again. Yeah. Do you know Dr. Vikas Shah?
Yeah, so I know Vikas.
Do you?
Know, big man in Manchester.
Yeah, he was on my, I think he was one of the first shows that I did here. And I was talking to him about the same sorts of subjects, you know, and I want to move on to boards in a moment, but... Yeah. Boards of directors and looking after them and, you know, and senior managers and about the pressures at work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, you know, he changed my mind actually, because I'm thinking that there's an obligation on a business to look after the psychological well-being of and mental health and well-being of their people.
Right? Yep.
Which there is.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had a chair of a charity that I work for as well, the National Star, which is, and Vikas had the same point that she made, it looks after severely handicapped and disabled youngsters, 16 to 25. And said, look, you can only do so much for some people.
Yep.
Yeah. And Vikas called it the scorecard. So everybody has a different scorecard where they, either where they're working, they've got a high score on their scorecard or they haven't.
Yep.
And actually, it's not a fact that then you need to go out of the way to help them.
Yep.
Do everything that you can. But actually that the environment is not right for them. So they end up leaving, as you said, the physical leaving.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, again, we need to appreciate that businesses have a reason why they exist. You know, it's usually to solve something or to create something. But that also means that that business works within its own ecosystem. It needs to be profitable to make impact. It needs to, you know, be able to hit its metrics to work. Otherwise, it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know... Not everyone can be comfortable all the time. People need to work hard. People need to, you know, work should always be a net positive for human beings, right?
Yeah.
You should be able to put effort into work, passion into work, time into work, you know, create relationships and build things at work.
And enjoy it.
And ultimately, you know, have a level of enjoyment doing it. It's not always going to feel easy, and it's not always going to be all smiles and happiness because it's part of a business, right?
But Lynette, who's the CEO of this charity, you know, the charity has two fundamental things that they look after. Mm-hmm. One is about the safeguarding of the kids and the care and education.
Yep.
Right. And if you can't hack that because either the pressure's too great or whatever, the organisation cannot move away from those objectives. So this is your point about, you know, an organisation has to make a profit to survive.
Yeah.
And of course it does.
Yeah.
So... It's then not the right environment. The person has a choice then.
Yes.
Whereas I, before I spoke to Vikas and Lynette, was of the view that it's black and white.
Mm-hmm.
the company must look after its people, full stop.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. It doesn't have to.
No.
Because of that reason.
No. And what I've seen is, I mean, I'll be brutally honest. I've got a work ethic, right? Because my parents had a work ethic. And there's a really fine balance between that. You don't want people to have a work ethic and burnout because they've not got that, you know, ability to find that equilibrium and they actually overwork themselves. But people, you don't want them to underwork themselves because they also burn out in like a bored.
The opposite way, yeah.
In a bored, you know, start to become disengaged because they're just not being challenged. You know, human beings like being challenged fundamentally. You know, we like something. Again, it comes back to that target. Set a human being a target, you know. Go and hit your target. And people should be like, right, okay, how do I do it? Rather than thinking,
It's knowing what they've got to achieve. Because, I mean, when I left Superdry, and I, you know, was well documented about them the following 10 years, mm-hmm. I'd lost a sense of purpose.
Yes.
And what you're saying is that people do need a sense of purpose because it gives them something to go for.
Yeah, but I think also people usually find purpose in the hardest times of their life. I look back and think, when did I find some of those threads of purpose of what's like meaningful to me? And it was when I couldn't walk. It was when my mental health was in the darkest places. Mm. It was when I was made redundant. And we do have like a self-help industry that's all like nice and happy about like, okay, you know, choose happiness, good vibes, be resilient, and find your purpose. But the truth is you don't find it. You kind of chisel it through the difficulties.
But it takes a certain amount of inner strength to do that, doesn't it? Mm. Because my lack of purpose descended me into what I'd call the black hole gravity well of depression. Mm-hmm. And frankly, you know, your motivation's gone, your diet's gone, your communication's gone, your relationships are struggling. You know, it's quite hard to suddenly lift your head up and say, right, what am I going to do today? You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Playing
definitely.
A joke at it, really. How can you help people in that situation, do you think?
Well, I think there's always an individual aspect to it. And I suppose it's been easier for me to get through some of the things I've got through because I've got through something else before. I've been able to see how I've fallen into a pit. But over time, I've been able to climb back out, even though it felt like I couldn't at the time. And I think, you know, when people overcome things, every human being is very, very resilient by nature. We've all overcome things. We take it for granted. We never think about what we've overcome. We don't look at the gain that we've made from where we were. We spend so much time looking at the gap to where we think we need to go.
Oh, God. This resonates so strongly with me.
And, you know, if as human beings we can start to look at the gain and see what we've learned, see how much we've developed, see how much we've grown, even when it feels like we've been stagnant, we actually, you know, we don't notice. It's like those micro moments, like I was saying, it compounds like a bank account.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, we have a lot more wisdom than we tend to think.
Yeah, you see, I tend to ignore the good things and I just focus on the bad things. And unfortunately, that is my personality type.
Yes.
And in a way, that will send me down a spiral, actually, and because I can't get rid of them. But picking up on what you're saying about just acknowledge the gains, if you like, and the wins. In the last 5 years, I've got an awful lot better at spotting them coming. So is my wife, actually. She knows when it's coming.
Yep.
And talking to myself, not in a bad way, but just saying, you've done this before. This has happened before. You know where this is going. So let's try and get yourself out of it. And I will do just a couple of extra things, something different. And it does, generally, it lifts me out relatively soon. Occasionally it doesn't, and I could be 2 or 3 months into a dark place. But yeah, it's very interesting how, but then how do you apply that at work then? It's just the lessons learnt, isn't it?
Yeah.
But giving freedom to make mistakes as well to people.
Yeah, because the thing is, that allows people to see that actually things go wrong. And, you know, we've got this challenging discourse around failure and quitting and these things being negative. And the truth is, you don't want to quit just when you've started most things.
Yeah.
Because the learning's coming trying and facing some resistance. But sometimes there is a time to quit things and take a step back and decide that actually the energy and the effort that's being put into this could be better put somewhere else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, I suppose when we kind of look and share stories in the workplace, we realise that every business goes through, there is no business that took off to the moon and never stopped. You know, it's like every single,
yeah.
You know, we think about the businesses that dominate the landscape today, and not one of them is what it started as.
And not one of them has had, as you say, the straight curve up.
Oh, no.
They've all had serious problems,
no.
Most of them. It's how you recover from it, isn't it?
Exactly.
And that's the point.
And the truth is, the more linear you progress in terms of success, the sharper and steeper the decline at the other side. Because you simply don't have opportunities to learn if you keep being successful.
Yeah.
You just become, quite complacent.
Yeah.
And actually, success isn't linear, and it shouldn't ever be for humans.
No, it shouldn't. Okay, so how then do you, I'm just going to change the subject slightly, but how then do you deal with the bad behaviour at work? Because some people can handle the pressures. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I always think about airline pilots, mm-hmm. who are notoriously balanced, calm, you know, clear, yes. thinking, because they have to be, right? Because of the circumstances that they're in. And they're deliberately chosen because of that. But in work, right, you don't get similar pressures, but you get pressures. But people, you know, you're not going to fall out of the sky.
Yeah.
So sometimes the behaviour transcends into something that's unacceptable. How can you stop that, and how can you help people to deal with the effect of that? Because talking, and this is the real crux of it, actually, mm-hmm. is talking about mental health at work is still very, very difficult. Very difficult.
Yeah. I mean, again, there's lots of facets to that, Charles. I mean, firstly, bullying is still rife in workplaces in the UK. You know, over 1 million people are being bullied at the minute. And, you know, the identification of that, because bullying still in our heads, this thing that happens in the school playground, but it happens at work as well.
Yeah, it does.
And it has a massive impact on people's mental health.
Well, it's what tipped me over the edge, actually, mm-hmm. if I'm honest. Yeah.
And if we think about things such as discrimination and harassment, especially for marginalised and minoritised groups in the workplace, it's even worse. Yeah. It's just an added extra thing to that as well. And obviously, we need to look and think, how do we equip managers to have conversations and the capacity to have those conversations? Really, at work, it fundamentally comes down to knowing your people.
Yeah, it's the individual, isn't it? It's the individual, somebody taking responsibility for their own behaviour,
yep.
and the way that they deal with other people at work. But is there a responsibility on other people to look out for, one, when it happens and mm-hmm. call it out, and two, just be aware of how people are. You know, somebody might be a bit off in terms of their reactions or the way that they speak to people on a day, and, you know, just checking in with them over a cup of coffee or something like that.
So a lot of what our business does, Chaz, is around self-awareness, because that self-awareness and understanding of yourself, your preferences, what works for you, helps you to understand, in terms of looking after yourself, what's good. Because what works for one person doesn't work very well for another.
No.
So, for example, I go walking in the evenings. That's my kind of release. First half of the walk helps my mind to, like, compartmentalise everything that's going on. Because otherwise my brain's, like, going at 1 million miles an hour and I can't sleep. The second half of the walk, when my brain's cleaned itself up, I get quite creative. So some of my best ideas have come on the second half of that walk. That's something that works for me, to help me sleep better, to help me move my body more, to get my blood flowing, and just helps me to be better. But for some people, they won't want that.
No. Where are you then on some of the well-being schemes that you see businesses doing now? Yeah, I could tell by your reaction.
Yeah, but back to the other point, Chaz.
Go on.
So that self-awareness piece.
I'm going to come back to that, though. But
that self-awareness piece for understanding yourself and what works for you. The self-awareness piece of understanding how you treat, interact, connect with other people impacts them. So that's why it's such an important aspect, and probably the first bit of leadership is to be self-aware of
what impact do you have on others?
How you are impacts others.
Yeah.
That also then opens up the big thing that I said earlier about getting to know your people.
Yeah.
Because quite often you'll see people who you work with, even in this hybrid world, more often than your closest friends and some of your family.
You spend more time at work, don't you?
So you will notice the nuances, the little differences. You'll know quite intimately sometimes about what that person's like, how they react to things, how they go about their business, what they do, the things that they say. You're also probably the first person to notice when that's a little bit different than the normal.
Yeah.
than the David or the Sandra or the Lisa that you're used to. So quite often, you will be the one to get the first small indicator that someone's struggling.
It will be small though, won't it? Because,
yes.
Because at home,
you people know, tend to...
Yeah. Whereas at work, you're hiding behind something because you don't actually want people to know.
Yeah, but not always. And sometimes we've got to consider that sometimes people's home environments are actually more challenging than people's work environments.
Yeah.
And that's, the balance isn't exactly the same. But I suppose during the pandemic, what we saw is that some people...
Oh, frightening.
Who obviously, you know, suffered things such as like domestic violence...
Well, it's bullying. It's bullying at home, isn't
bullying
it?
Bullying at home
it's
and stuff like that.
Moved into the home and away from the workplace.
And it's like suddenly you've got people through a camera bullying you in your own domestic space, or maybe even your own family. And it's thinking there's lots of different cultural aspects to this as well. So it's really complex, Chaz, when you look at it and map it out. But what you realise is fundamentally, like, people need that self awareness of themselves to know what works for them, so they can look after themselves better. Then they become more able to look after others.
Comes back to Vickers's scorecard, doesn't it? You need to know what your own scorecard is.
Yeah.
And actually, you need to know what the scorecard is of other people as well. Because I remember years ago doing a piece of awareness test, personality testing at Guinness, right? And this was about, you find out what type of person you were. It's I can't remember what it's called, actually.
There's all sorts. Myers-Briggs.
No, it wasn't that. It was Merrill Reed. No, that's not Myers-Briggs. I don't know. I can't remember. But there were four types.
Yeah.
And what they then did is they find out what type you are, but then most importantly mapped the interaction that those two people are likely to have.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, you're much more aware of... One, you know what the other person is, because it's clear they've told you. You know they know what you are, and you know where you have to move to meet in the middle.
Yeah,
and the meetings and the conversations suddenly got hugely more productive.
Yeah, and it works. And what's interesting is some of the more modern models also now look at where do those people move to when things become more stressful.
Well, funnily enough, because that model does that.
Mm-hmm.
When you get stressed, it did a Boston Matrix grid, classical thing.
Boston
right?
Matrix.
Yeah, I know.
Oh,
no, yeah. They're good. They're good.
I love a good Boston Matrix.
Yeah, good for clarity of thinking for me, anyway. Right. So when you've got bottom right dealing with top left.
Yeah.
Sorry, I've got that the wrong way around, but and they come together, and that's good. But actually, when they get stressed, they move out that way.
Yes.
And the behaviour becomes different.
Yeah.
And again, you said this. So you would almost advocate then, it's about individual self awareness and understanding of other people that helps the most. Is that fair summary?
I mean, it does, but also that requires an organisational ecosystem for that to happen. Because if you're in a business where, for example, managers don't have the capacity to be able to do that, then they're not going to get to know the people because they've not got time. They've got other priorities.
They probably don't know how to either.
And,
and also,
like, one of the biggest barriers is, like I said, you know, managers get a lot of flack. Everyone probably from the career knows a really bad manager and remembers it, and knows a really good manager and remembers them. And managers have a really powerful ability to make a difference to not only the teams they lead, but the peers and the leaders as well. But obviously, when it comes to these things, managers being competent enough to have the conversations, have the capacity to have the conversations, and have the capability to sometimes listen to quite difficult things, it's so important.
It is, because I guess psychological safety in a work sense is giving people permission to be able to say how they are.
Yes.
Yeah. And that is so difficult because there's a natural resistance of somebody, particularly who's young, newly in a job maybe, and thinking, fine, struggling a bit, you know, putting their hand up, and suddenly their career's compromised, you know, the instances of getting sacked and demoted and sidelined is many.
Yep.
So how do you get over that bit? How do you create that permission environment?
Yeah, so... numerous different ways, Chaz. I think, firstly, I mean, I'm not one for intergenerational stereotypes, right? Because I meet people who are 70 and people who are 15, and they can be very similar. Sometimes we kind of segment generations to be like, well, this generation's like this and this generation's like that.
Yes, I said young, didn't I? And I shouldn't have said that. I should have just said people.
Oh, no, but it's especially the younger generation are obviously coming into the workplace and have less of the "this is how the work should be" etiquette that's been piled onto older people for years and years and years.
Fantastic. But it could take 25, 30 years for them to come through and make everything okay.
Yeah. So, but you know, generally speaking, younger people are more open, a lot more kind of understanding, but also aware of things around mental health, diversity, sustainability.
I think it was Vikas who said, actually, that the young are now interviewing the person more than it being one way. So, you know, tell me how you look after people. Tell me what
they are going,
support network.
And they are saying, we'll prove it.
Yeah.
Prove that this is a good place to work.
Yeah, and if it's not, I'm not coming. I'm not interested. I don't care how much you're going to pay me. And which I think that's just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
But also, that presents a challenge where expectations of, you know, we don't share our weaknesses, we don't be too vulnerable, there's a tax to being too vulnerable. It's still attitudes in the workplace. So it's a balance. It's quite a lot.
Sorry, no, I didn't understand that. Can you say that in a different way?
So I speak to people and they say there's a level to this, being able to share exactly how you're feeling.
Because in terms of what they're prepared to say, do you mean?
Well, yeah, in terms of some people still feel, I don't want to disclose stuff at work.
Yeah, because
I feel
it's personal.
It's personal. Yeah. It might get used against me. In our culture, we don't do that. We don't talk about these things. Whereas some people are very, very open book and very much like, I'm willing to be wholly vulnerable about everything that I say. And I'm not even going to consider what impact that might have. And in some places, it's very difficult to be like that.
Yeah.
Because a workplace creates a level of safety to share things. And if you're in an organization that's being ruled by fear,
you're not going to say anything.
You're not going to say anything. No. You're just going to...
Even if you want to, you're not going to
exactly.
say anything.
Yeah. So it's understanding the ecosystem that you're in. And does it facilitate those conversations, which can be difficult, which can be challenging? And, you know, I speak to, you know, senior people all the time. And what they quite often say is, we're being encouraged to be vulnerable and open. And that's good, right? Open and being transparent are good things in business, because if we know what's going on, we can make decisions and choices, we can support people, and it's good. But we still have an element of the vulnerability tax, where if I open up too much about my struggles, what are our investors going to think? What's the board going to think about my decision making?
You see, that's very interesting, because I'm going to hark back to my question a little while ago about well-being schemes and all that sort of stuff. Right. And, you know, you've got the organisation trying to do their best. I say this so often, I've probably edited out actually, but you've got organisations looking after the well-being, however, whether it's the individual or the teams or interactions or whatever. Right. You've then got a board of directors in the middle, right, and the shareholders above.
Yeah.
Now, the shareholders, frankly, don't give a toss, actually, about the bit that's going on in the organisation. They just want to be able to read it in the annual report that says, yeah, we look after our staff. Yeah, and that sort of pushes it to one side. It's something they don't have to worry about. But actually, the more they are, they're really only interested in a return on investment.
Yep.
Yeah. That means that the behaviour at board level is very different to the behaviours that you can instill into an organisation, because the pressures and the stakeholders are different.
Yeah.
So how do you create that psychological safety for that board of directors where conversations are behind closed doors, confidential, behaviour is fucking appalling, let's be frank about this, or can be, should I say, it's not always, and it never gets called out. And people suffer around that table but don't say anything because, you know, you're supposed to be strong and, you know, you're a tough businessman, you know, hard-nosed and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
How do you work with board level?
So not that much.
And that's interesting in itself.
There's reasons why, Chaz. The power dynamic in board level is a real challenge to orient. Like you say, the reality is that at board level, there's expectations around shareholder value that mean that any of these discussions get sidelined unless it's a reputational risk. And that's the only time
it is
that they will step in and say, right, we need to actually do something because, you know, we need to
We're not going to gain investment if we don't do it. Yeah.
We need to try and get some level of operational change in this area because it's going to affect our trajectory, or it's going to become such a risk that it puts us in a place where, you know, the brand or the organisation might actually be tarnished in some way that's going to be detrimental to the commerciality.
Which could be fatal, let's face it.
Well, exactly, though, exactly, yeah. You know. So, I mean, in those, I mean, and I am obviously on a board myself and kind of...
Of course you are, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, but the reality is, Chaz, that boards are always going to be interesting places because just very nature of what it sits. You sit there in a place of strategic advisory to some of the biggest entities in the world. In fact, if we think about the 200 richest entities that exist on this planet, over 150 are companies, not nations.
Yes.
Companies.
Yes.
So yes. Companies hold an awful lot of power. And in those boardrooms...
It's played out.
That power is played out and wielded.
But it can still be wielded and played out. But why does it sometimes have to be done in such an appalling manner? You know, and it is that... It goes back to playground bullying.
Mm-hmm.
And the language that's used is similar. The tone of voice is similar. The aggression that you get sometimes, and why does it have to be like that? And I know you're all under pressure, but I don't get that. I really don't get that.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, even if you look across boards, Chaz, very few of the younger generation have felt that they've been able to get board positions because it's been historically something that, you know, you get with lots of experience, and you've got lots of experience and lots of egos in a room.
Yeah.
And people are told in that space, you need to challenge each other. Now, obviously, some boards, there are such strong characters that they don't get challenged, and that can be fatal for businesses.
Yeah.
And we've seen some charities and some big businesses end up in a really bad place because no one was willing
to domineering.
No one was willing to call it out.
Yeah, look at Arcadia. Was it Arcadia with Philip Green? Was he Arcadia? I think he was. Burton's and Debenhams and so on. You know, I mean... apocryphal they may be, but the stories around his and his behaviour was pretty bloody poor.
That's when that photographer decided to place him between two round bushes and that kind of famous picture of him stood there.
I don't remember that. I wish I'd seen that. I'm going to dig that out, actually. it's worth having as my screensaver, I think. I get all of that. But I now, because I've had my mind changed, I now come back to this. Well, actually, if you don't want to be there, don't be there.
Yeah.
That is the environment. That's how it is at that level, because the stakes are phenomenally high, particularly if you think 150 are the biggest things in the world. So you have a choice. You have a choice, and your scorecard will tell you whether that is the right place for you. And trouble is sometimes people get caught on a... the mill. The mill, what do you call it? Hamster wheel, where they can't get off it.
Yeah.
And so they end up going up and up and up, and the money's nice, it's great, and you know, the cars and the houses and the, you know, the kids at private school, well, that's very nice, but actually the cost to you as an individual coming back to your own sense of identity is too high sometimes. But you're actually getting people to understand that, and I suppose that's where you come in, isn't it?
Yeah.
And what you do.
Well, yeah, and I think that when people share that their journeys, when people build that self-awareness, they understand where they want to take and use that energy. They actually take and think about where can they... You know, the scorecard aspect is like human beings, we're a bit like a top trump. We are all like a top trump. and you know, we've got a little top trump that we take around with us. And there are some areas where we score pretty highly. There's some areas where, you know, we really don't. And it's kind of understanding, you know, where's the best place for our top trump in the deck? Because there is a place for us.
Yeah.
There is a place where we can play and do really well. There's also places where, you know, our top trump, we're just not gonna do well.
No, you're so right. I mean, that's absolutely right. But then you overlay that, bringing in a bit more complexity, which of course you will like, is social media. The stuff that you see on there. You know, and I bloody despair of people using it, you know, flicking through and just looking at shit. But all they're doing is looking at imagery that people have probably photoshopped to make themselves look better. And so you end up wanting to be like them.
Well, yeah. The problem is, Charles, that as animals, we socially compare. We do it even if we're told not to, and even if we try not to. And there's reasons for that. We didn't want to get expelled from the tribe when we were more primitive, because simply, we've always been prey on this planet. We've never been predators.
Yeah.
We've got retractable thumbs. That's great. But that doesn't really do well when you're up against a saber-toothed tiger or something that's a lot more aggressive and going to shred you to bits.
Yeah.
You know, retractable thumbs are really nice for tools and nice little things. Yeah. But we've always been prey. And in fact, we've managed to create a world where there's no predators anymore.
Because we've developed the tools to be able to deal with it.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, that's great. We've managed to grow this, you know, this lovely big brain to be able to do that, and then kind of destroyed most of the world by doing it as well. You know, humans, again, I just sometimes despair at us as a species that for all the ability that we've got, we actually seem to make the same mistakes over and over again.
Yeah, we've really fucked it up this time.
But that aspect of understanding that human beings don't want to get excluded, because the way we were able to hunt really effectively before we developed tools was to just outrun things. We're really efficient at sweating. That's our superpower.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we could outrun, you know, like deer and similar type of animals.
Yeah, we run them down, don't we?
We run them down, and they would start to pant. They wouldn't be able to manage that, and they'd get dehydrated, and eventually we'd win.
Yeah,
and
we carry water with us, which has the exact effect of hydrating you.
The reality is, if you had to hunt on your own, you were never going to catch anything.
No.
And you'd be reliant on the flora and the fauna around you to try and scavenge and, you know, try and hopefully survive. But it was never going to be it again. And our target was to survive. If you got expelled from the tribe, you weren't surviving.
No.
So we always want to fit in, and we always want to belong. And that means we're always going to compare. And social media has created a world where for the younger generation, like, who did I compare myself to? Well, the people around me, people I knew, family, friends, people who lived down the street, people I went to school with. You had comparison within your own social circle.
Yeah.
Now you can compare yourself to someone on the other side of the world. And
who's been phenomenally successful.
Well, yeah,
and
exactly.
And makes you yearn, and actually isn't good for your well-being, is it? It's not good for your own sense of self-worth.
Well, it's really bad, Chas, because, you know, young people today are in a very different position. So I grew up in the north, right? Like, born in 85, so kind of thinking in the 90s, thinking like, ooh, 30 grand's a lot of money. If I'm earning 30 grand a year, that's quite... Rich people earn 30 grand a year. Nowadays...
Is that a living wage? I
think it is. But also, I mean, things have inflated massively. Yeah. Let's be like honest about that. But nowadays, you've got young people thinking if they're not earning six figures in a few years, they're not doing a good job.
Yeah, my son's like that. You know, my son's doing reasonably well.
Yep.
Yeah. He's just got a young family, so he's got other pressures and so on. He's at Superdrive, funnily enough.
Yep.
And he worries about the fact that he's not earning enough.
Yeah, and it's like, but for the younger generation in school, they're having people online telling them, drop out of school. School's the old way of doing it. Come and do my course. and you'll make millions, and you'll be a millionaire, and you'll break the system, and you'll get rich, and you'll be able to afford anything you want.
You see that? Yeah, that really does frighten me, because that is preying on people's vulnerabilities.
But it's we still live in a hyper-capitalist system.
Yes, we do. Yeah.
So that's attractive. It's the same reason why boards behave the way that they do.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, we live in these systems.
Yeah. Jeff McDonald, sorry again interrupting, but Jeff McDonald was on here, and he was a global VP of HR for a big part of Unilever.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about capitalism 2.0, which is, capitalism's fine, right?
Yep.
Because it means you all grow and you all benefit.
Yep.
But actually, it's about looking after everybody. It's not about, and it comes back to your teamwork, if I can use that, as opposed to tribe work, about you all work together and help each other and bring each other along and, you know, recognize people's skills in certain areas and recognizing your own skills in certain areas. And I thought, yeah, there's a lot of sense in that, actually. There's a lot of sense.
And it's kind of, if you look from an evolutionary perspective, like tribes used to fight against each other.
Well, but bringing it back to its basic level, you think about chimpanzees or the great apes. You know, they go around in tribes, and every now and again they go on a raid and try and, you know.
But when big challenges came, they actually worked together. They actually came together and collaborated.
That's true. And I'm thinking about David Attenborough here, because mm-hmm. you see them, mm-hmm. you know, there's some predator prowling around. The tribes yeah. will come together and yeah. fight off the predator.
And that's what human beings need to do to this day, because yeah. we do need, like, capitalism 2.0, where it's not about shareholder value, but stakeholder value. That means that there's value, not just, there is commercial value, because businesses ultimately are just stories.
Yeah. But how strong would that make everybody and everything if we did that, rather than trying to beat people up and yeah. put roadblocks in the way?
The beauty is...
Which is where we started yeah. this conversation, in a way.
And if we had stakeholder value, it wouldn't just be shareholders. It would be shareholders, but it would also be employees, communities...
Suppliers.
You know, you'd have five different, you know, stakeholders being looked after, including the planet.
Yeah.
So...
Well, on that note, bloody hell, we've solved it, haven't we? That's it. We know what to do. But you're out there doing it, and I'm here talking about it. Lee, honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure. It really has. Thank you very much for coming in. I say this to everybody, but I genuinely mean it this time. Not that I don't mean it last time. I think we could talk forever on mm-hmm. it, actually.
Quite possibly.
Because it's such a big subject, and you've achieved a lot, and you've also got an awful lot more to deliver and help other people. So thank you once again for being on Just Not Good Enough.
No, thank you, Chaz.